Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. In last week's episode, I spoke to Mike Grell, and we talked about his art style. And he had mentioned that, unlike a lot of other people who use inkers, Mike takes his pencils directly, draws on vellum. That vellum is transferred onto art paper, and the stuff gets colored, and that's how the process happens for his art. There's another great artist that came a bit before Mike, but was a contemporary of his and continues to produce great work today, the great Gene Colan, who you know from work on Daredevil, Captain America, and so many Marvel projects, but also great DC work, good stuff for Batman and Wonder Woman, and went on to do some great stuff with Don McGregor, things like Nathaniel Dusk, an interesting Private Eye series that he did. And Gene also is a guy that likes to, as he say, paint with pencils. In 2005, I had an excellent conversation with Gene, and really was a good career-spanning conversation, and had such a wonderful time speaking with him. It was on my old RSS feed. I haven't put it on the new one, so for those of you who haven't heard it, I'm going to represent the interview today, and I hope you enjoy it. Very pleased to speak with Gene. I hope to see him in New York at the New York Comic Con, which is coming up in 2008, in just a month. So if you're out there as well, make sure you stop by and say hello. But I hope you enjoy this conversation that I had with Gene talking about his career, and we present it again here on Word Balloon. The conversation starts with Gene going back to his days as a boy, and he talks about some of the early comic strips that were among his favorites.
My favorite was, it appeared in the New York Sun, Dicky Dare. That was something I think Kniff had before he ever got into Terry and the Pirates. Eventually, an artist by the name of Colton Waugh, W-A-U-G-H. He did it, and I was just, I really sunk into that one. Dicky Dare, I could not wait for the next day's episode. It was a daily thing. It didn't appear in the Sunday paper, though. And my father would come home from business and out of the New York subway, and I'd grab the Sun up before he even got to the last step. So that was a very big thing. I looked at the others, too, Alex Raymond and Flash Gordon. And Prince Valiant, Harold Foster.
Sure.
And especially Milton Caniff.
In our previous conversation, you mentioned you're a film buff.
Yes.
And that the frame composition in a film would inspire the way you would design panels.
Yes. I grew up in the age of black and white movies. And I didn't care much for color because I never saw real life in color. It's just you pass through your days and not even think about color. I don't know why that is. It just never occurred to me. And the black and white presentation was always more dramatic. I just love the variations of gray tone that you would get in a black and white film. And I believed it better. Even though everything was in gray, I somehow or other fell for the story a lot faster than if it were in color. Color scene is almost like a very unreal presentation.
Can you name some filmmakers that inspired your work?
Well, yeah, probably could. You caught me off guard. One of my all-time favorites was Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Oh, yeah. Was that John Huston?
John Huston.
Sure.
His father was in it.
So, yes, Walter Huston, yes.
Yeah. I remember that very well, and boy, what a movie that was. And there were others.
How about Billy Wilder? I'm thinking some of the noir directors.
Yes, him also. Didn't he do The Apartment?
Yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did.
Yes.
And Double Indemnity?
And Double Indemnity, right. They were great films. Great. I even liked the Sherlock Holmes series.
Basil Rathbone.
Yeah. He was the definitive Sherlock Holmes, and I don't care how many other characters took his place through the years. Nobody pulled it off and or looked like, I think, Sherlock Holmes should look than Basil Rathbone. He was fantastic.
No, I agree with you. Mm. Your wife describes your style as painting with pencils.
Yes.
How finished were your pencils, pencil drawings before the inkers would get the pages?
Pretty finished. Any decent inker could follow it. I had a tendency to put in half tones, which it would confuse the inker or put him on a path that he didn't care to deal with. Not all inkers. Some inkers would accept it as a challenge, but most of them, you know, they wanted to turn the work out, so they would abbreviate whatever I had there. They would either leave it out or, they would just plain leave it out. They wouldn't put in half tones. They wouldn't bother with it. Not until Tom Palmer came along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a great fit for you.
Yes, he was. And I also liked Al Williamson a lot.
Sure.
Because he would put in his tone work with a Crocol pen. and he would do it with fine line. He was a wonderful artist, and so was Tom. We did that Dracula series for 10, 11 years, something like that, on a regular run.
And how fast would you be able to draw a page when you were on that monthly schedule and you had several monthly books running?
I had to do at least two a day.
Wow.
And that was an awesome thing. I mean, everything had to go by the boards. I would sit down, and I guess around 9 o'clock in the morning, and I wouldn't be finished until maybe 2 or 3, I mean, in the following morning. So it was a grueling thing. I was never fast. I tried to be at different times when I got a little fed up with the late hours and all, but it didn't hang around long because I knew it wasn't my best, and I would almost, without noticing it, drift back into my old routine of being slow and very, very ultra-careful. And that took time.
With the advances in technology, obviously that helps your style. You don't have to worry about an anchor because they can
take
your work.
Anything. Yeah, they can. And I've seen the colorist's record job, too.
Sure.
Today, with all of the technical things at their fingertips, the coloring has a tendency to be dark. And my pencils are dark enough, so dark on top of dark makes it almost impossible to read. It depends on the colorist as to what he wants to do with the job. If he wants to make a job that anyone can see and understand, he could do it. But I don't know what happens. Maybe they think that they're expected to do it dark because that's how I generally work. You know, that's why they call the book In the Shadows. I don't really know. It certainly helped, as far as I'm concerned, to be able to have my pencils reproduced for the comic books.
And a lot of your recent work is like that now, and
it's all that way.
That's wonderful. Are you able to work with colorers today when you are a colorist?
Well, I will give color notes, or I would tell them on the phone. I would tell the editor that they should put highlights here and not there. Color the characters or the entire panel in a very sparing way.
Have you tried to draw with a computer yourself these days?
No, I have no interest in doing it.
It would seem like your subtle style of shading might be lost or harder to replicate.
No, if I'm trying to paint something, put a wash effect over it, I'd rather do it all myself, by hand, with a brush, rather than to go into the mechanics of what a very smooth, slick-looking job. I think it takes away from the character of the work, and then that's totally lost. Then it looks like an airbrush slick. It could be, too, that I'm old-fashioned and I don't really want to get into all these modern things. as far as computers are concerned, I'll leave that to Hollywood.
Going back to some of your early years, it seems like you did every genre they would throw at you. You were capable of whether it was Western, science fiction, romance, heroes.
Whatever they would tell me to do, even if I was not familiar with that type of artwork, If dragons were involved or cities under the sea, which I hated doing, because that was really like science fiction, and I had to really stretch to pull that off, and I wasn't good at it. I never thought I was good at that. Present-day stuff that everybody knows about, I can do.
Okay.
But when they throw in science fiction and things that never have been seen before, where it's up to the imagination of the artist, I didn't feel that was anything that I would want to get into. I didn't really enjoy it, but I would never turn it down. I would do the very best I could do with it. But I didn't like it.
Well, now that's interesting because I was going to ask about your run on The Submariner in Tales to Astonish.
Didn't enjoy it.
Very interesting.
No, I didn't because I didn't like The Submariner's head. The shape of the head, it was very difficult for me to do because it's flat on the top, and you didn't have a chance. I didn't feel that I could get into making him as a good-looking person with that flat head of his. But that's what they gave me again, and even though I didn't like it, I would go along with it. I might have said something here or there to Stan that, can you put me on a different book? I would be better in doing something else.
Did you ever discuss with Bill Everett, because he was a contemporary with you in the 60s in Marvel, and he certainly had that history creating the character.
No, I never did.
Okay.
No.
And he followed you on Submariner, it seems.
Yes, I think he created that character.
He did, and then came back to it in the 60s after your run.
I never followed up with Bill as to what he did after or before.
Okay.
He was there in the art department. I knew him pretty well. It never went beyond that. In fact, the only one I really enjoyed and was privileged to be in his company with Sid Shaw's.
Yes, the Captain America artist of the 50s.
Yes, he could. You talk about westerns and stuff like that. He could do anything with no scrap. And he was sensational.
And he helped guide your style and help refine it?
Yes.
Okay.
I ran into an artistic problem, which were many at that time, because I didn't know a thing. I was as green as grass. And he would come right in and show me in a split second where I went wrong and how easy it would be to do it right.
Who is Adam Austin?
Oh, well, I was working for DC then.
Okay.
And I felt that if DC knew I was working for Marvel, that might cause a problem for me, because they were in an area where they wanted to keep the artists that they had. They didn't want them wandering over to other people.
Sure.
So I spoke to Stan about it, because I was working for Marvel or Timely, and Stan said, "Well, look, let's give you another name, you know." But you know, artwork is like handwriting. You cannot disguise it. People that are into the art will know, can pick your work out almost blindfolded. It's nothing you really can disguise. So I didn't get away with it. Everybody knew who I was, Adam Austin, so I just dropped the name after a while. I said, "Oh, the heck with this."
Was Iron Man your next assignment?
I don't know exactly who came first. I think Daredevil, then Iron Man. Captain America was in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There were others, too.
Let's talk about Daredevil then. You took over after John Romita left, and I'm assuming that was when he left to pick up Spider-Man from Ditko.
Yes.
And then you took over Daredevil. Was there an idea that you had going in that you wanted to convey in the character that you had?
I loved the way John Romita did it, so I picked up just the way he did it. And by familiarity through the months that passed, I began in subtle ways to make changes on the body itself. The costuming was always there, but I slimmed them down a wee bit. My style did creep in, although I wasn't aware of any style. It just happened, just like that. You get involved in the storytelling of it and the drawing of it, and how can I make it look better or different than I've done it before. Those are the things I got involved with. And how realistic could I make it, and could I convince the reader that this is not just a comic book? This may be the real thing.
Well, yeah, and where did you get your inspiration for some of those acrobatic positions that he had?
Probably the films.
Okay.
I'm trying to think, maybe some Tarzan movie. I really don't know where I got that from.
Okay.
There it was, and I had to make something of it. And so I would begin to pick up photographs, information that would help me vary the poses and put them in something different than the typical stuff. And so many of those moves were made up and were so exaggerated. Jack Kirby was a big help there, too. I mean, not where he would converse with me and tell me how I could do it better, or nor did I ask him. He was just, I didn't really know him. Other than to meet him in the hall and say hello.
So did you work in the bullpen, or would you work
yes,
at home?
Yes, I did. I started out in the bullpen.
Okay. And you've mentioned John Buscema as being, or John Buscema as
yeah, he was sitting up a couple of seats ahead of me.
Okay.
He came along very shortly after I started. And then almost immediately, John Romita came in. And then I think after him, John Buscema, I'm not so sure of the order, but they were very close, coming on to Timely at the time.
In 1969, you had three top-selling books where you were doing the art: Captain America, Daredevil, and Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
And that must have been a grueling schedule to get three of those books out. They were all very popular at the time as well.
Yeah, I just wouldn't, I couldn't say no. So I would take on more than I really should have.
Your Doctor Strange was really interesting because you still conveyed amazing work on the magic end of things,
mm-hmm.
but as you say, you seem to enjoy a lot of the cityscapes, and your cityscapes with Doctor Strange had much more realism, especially on making Greenwich Village look right.
Well, I would go in with a camera to Greenwich Village. I had a Polaroid camera, one of the first that came out, and I would go down there and photograph the village during the daytime, and sometimes even at night. And that's what I use for reference. I rather than dream it up, any artist can sit down and dream up buildings.
Mm-hmm.
But are they real? Do they look convincing? You know, the architecture in New York is quite something on some of the older buildings.
Sure.
And I figured, well, whoever knows New York will recognize everything. And for those that have never been, will also be interested. Because the buildings were all from reference. Everything was from reference. The cars in the street, and sometimes the street itself. Usually that way, yeah. The street would be also referenced. I enjoyed it. I had a very good time doing all that stuff. And then bringing it together in the story. I'd have a whole bunch of photographs in front of me. This was more on a freelance basis when I started doing that.
Okay.
When I was working in the bullpen, I didn't do any of that. But when I was in, then when we all had to, when we all left Timely and went into freelancing, that's mm-hmm. when I was at home, that's when I was more at ease, and I could sort of concentrate more on what I thought would improve the art.
Did you then have, you know, a file that you would refer to in terms of...
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I still have it with me. You should see some of the old cars that existed at that time. I still have kept them, but you never know when you're going to get a period piece.
Well, and your style, too, lends itself to those kind of more realistic crime stories.
Well, I guess, yeah, it did, but...
In a good way.
Yes, some of the stories that I had.
And
there was a very old car that I use a lot in Dracula. it looked like an old Packard.
Sure.
I used that. It looked like a car that a chauffeur only would drive.
Very cool.
It was a toy, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it had all the right looks. It looked pretty darn authentic, so I would use that. And that also grew into planes, and I still have them. Fighter aircraft that existed during the First War.
Wow.
And I don't have much else other in that category, nor do I have ships, but I do have folders on it. And whatever books I could buy at the time that would enhance it, I would get those books. I was always trying to think ahead. What might I need if something like Dragons showed up or something that I haven't done before? And you have to kind of think ahead as what the possibilities would be for you. To have stories that you're not too familiar with but do need scrap for. I tried to, in many instances, that was Rolls Royces was one car that would come up often, and I would find one on the street somewhere and photograph. I once went into a showroom pretending I was interested in buying one. And so they gave me a brochure showing the Rolls Royce in various positions, you know.
Sure.
Profile, back view, front view.
Interior, yeah.
And all that, yeah. And when I moved to Vermont, they had an antique car show every year. And all these cars, the real thing.
Wow.
So I'd take my camera and spend a whole day at the show photographing one after the other.
Well, before we leave the subject of cars, we should acknowledge a scene that I know that you're proud of in Captain America 116. A car chase between Cap and the Red Skull.
That's right.
Talk about that and what inspired
bullet.
You.
I was a very, I was so enthralled with the film Bullet.
The Steve McQueen film?
Yeah. I've never seen a car chase ever on the screen like that. Usually it's on for a minute or two and then it's over. But this was the biggest attempt at a car chase. And I knew that there were that this car chase was going to be special the minute they buckled up in the car, put on the safety belt, because that would prepare the audience for a thrill, and that's exactly what they got, and especially me. And so I waited for an opportunity in any of the books that I was doing, Daredevil or Captain America, where I could do that, and I eventually got one. No one else had that in mind but mm-hmm. me, and I must have eaten up maybe 5 or 6 pages, something like that, of a car chase scene. Stan was furious because it ate into the plot. And then I'd be squeezed at the end to try to fit everything in there. The readers loved it. They sent in their thinking on it, and it caught the attention of a lot of fans.
Now, you were creating these stories in the Marvel style back then. Stan would, like, kind of give you the germ of a story, and then it was up to you to really flesh it out.
Oh, yeah.
And then he would dialogue it later.
Right.
And you've told me that you used to work not from thumbnails. You would kind of work extemporaneously.
That's right. I would just start with panel one. I'd read the script ahead a little bit, up to maybe the third page, and I would see that not much changes as to where the characters are and what's happening.
How big was, like, an early script from Stan before you started drawing? How long was the script?
Oh, maybe 18 pages, something in that area.
About the length of the actual book?
Of the whole story.
Okay.
He would just give me and any of the other artists that could do it a brief thumbnail idea of what the plot was. This is the beginning, this is the middle, and that's the end. And I would, I wouldn't come into the city with that. I would tape record him telling me this over the phone.
Okay.
And that way I could follow the message that he left for me on the recorder and space it out the way he tells it. And I would figure, well, this will take just so many pages, and this should take so many, and I would equal it out until I felt that it would, in my mind now, I didn't make notes or anything, that it should eat up about 18 pages. Worth of art and to tell the story. And sometimes I would run into trouble, and other times I would be right on the nail head, and it was more of a, I just couldn't stand doing thumbnail sketches of these things. I just wanted to get right to it, you know?
Would it have been repetitive to thumbnail and then draw it in big form?
Yeah, it might take away some of the pleasure of being surprised by the story. I said that I would read maybe two or three pages ahead to make sure that there are no location changes and no clothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would figure, well, not much happening here. And they're doing a particular thing, and it takes up three pages to do it. So I would start, you know?
Sure.
And I was usually on the money. I don't think I ever regretted doing it that way. Now, John Romita was a more careful artist. He would try to make certain that everything would be just right. And he would, felt that he had to have these thumbnail sketches to tell it properly. I wasn't as exacting as that. I've never been that way, and I might have been better if I had. But I just, you know, as being myself.
Sure.
And hoping and praying that it all worked out. I was more or less flying by the seat of my pants with these things.
Now, your nickname was The Dean, and I know that was obviously a rhyme with your name, but Stan would always give nicknames for the alliteration, like Jaunty or Jolly Jack.
Yeah.
But being The Dean, did some of the young artists come to you for advice on how to design a page?
No.
Really?
No. Never had anyone ask me, how should I do this? No.
No, okay.
No, each artist just did his thing.
You followed Steranko on Cap, and you really had, which was a tough act to follow, because really for such a small body of work, Steranko really came and shook things up, I think, as far as his book on Cap.
Yes.
And you followed up with some really interesting stories, and also one of them involved Cap in Vietnam, and you also had Daredevil in Vietnam, too.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Stan was writing the book at the time. Was there any flack about, you know, covering the story? I mean, it certainly wasn't anything new. There were World War II stories happening during the war.
No.
Same thing for Vietnam, I guess.
No, there was no problem with any of it. In fact, I was doing stuff of the Korean War. You know, where they'd come over the hill and charge, blowing bugles and everything. So I did a lot of war stuff, a lot, during those years. You know, it was a cut-and-dried thing. The story would be written, and it was up to the artist and the bullpen to turn them out.
Well,
and I really got involved with that because I've seen a lot of war films, and I enjoy them all. And that would help a lot, an awful lot. And then when I met Severin, John Severin,
mm-hmm.
who was as exacting as you could get with uniforms and weapons, he would draw like the M1 rifle. Right down to the last nut and screw. And he wouldn't miss anything, and he was very accurate with them, and he put me onto a military book with all of these weapons photographed in there. And that was a big source of mine for war weapons, and I insisted that they be very accurate. Eventually, it led to a collection of guns. the real thing, because I lived in Vermont, it's very easy to have a gun.
I see.
In Vermont, and so I had rifles, I had handguns, and eventually I sold them all, you know, because I moved.
Okay.
And I'm down here, now we all want to move back, but not to Vermont.
No? Where are you thinking of moving?
Manhattan.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, I don't know if I could afford it, but we're going to go forward with it anyway.
Well, good luck with that.
We'll see what happens.
Unlike you, I'm a city guy. I need action.
You live in Manhattan?
I live in Chicago, actually.
Oh, you know what? Chicago looks exactly, or New York looks exactly like Chicago.
Sure, those old-style working-class cities, absolutely.
Oh, I was confused recently. I went to the Chicago convention, and I thought that I was on Fifth Avenue. Actually, on Fifth, thought I was there. It threw me, really did. But the difference is that New York has a lot of schmutz. Garbage laying all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
At least it did when I was there last. But Chicago, you could eat off the sidewalk.
I wouldn't, but okay.
I know, but there isn't any indication of garbage pails.
You're right. You're right.
It's a very clean city.
I'll pass that on to the mayor. I think he'll appreciate that. That's good.
It is an apple pie order. Yeah, it is. And I have a lot of the old architecture there that you see in New York.
You bet. Let's talk about Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah.
And it had Boston as its backdrop, and I know you said you did a lot of photo...
Yeah, I went to Boston to photograph there as well. And I love doing Dracula. And I love some of the characters that Marv Wolfman had eventually put in it. Harold, I think was his
yes.
name. He kind of looked like a Woody Allen or something. A goofy-looking guy.
Well, that was such an interesting book. And first of all, what was it like doing a horror book after they had been banned by regular comics for so long?
Oh, I loved it. I didn't wonder about it being banned or anything. If it was out there and they made it into a comic book and they wanted me to do it, oh, that was all I needed to know.
There were no comic code authority concerns in terms of what you could do or anything?
I don't remember on Dracula. There was a comic code that had to be obeyed. And then eventually Marvel and all the other companies ran into a lot of trouble.
Back in the 50s, yes.
Yeah, around there. And then there was the big threat of these companies just folding up. And along with it went all the jobs, me included. I was out of work in comics for about 5-6 years.
Yeah, that was a real tough time when the industry really kind of folded into itself.
Yes,
and so many companies had gone away.
That's right.
Now, you said you've always been fascinated by horror.
Yes.
Going back to a child.
Yes.
What was the film that really shook you up?
The first thing, I was 5 years old, and I lived in the Bronx. My father took me to see Frankenstein. It traumatized me forever.
Wow.
I was a basket case when I came out of there. I couldn't sleep. It was impossible to deal with. But even before that, Halloween Fright the Daylights out of me. I would not go in the streets. I didn't want to because the kids knew it, you know. They'd come out with these false faces and I'd run like hell.
That's pretty amazing then to feel that way as a child and then to do the body of work you did with Dracula. As you say, 10 or 11 years at Marvel and then subsequent miniseries following that, both at Marvel and at Dark Horse.
Yes, I just love the atmosphere in it. You know, old castles, the cemeteries, the fog. All that stuff. I've always been interested in that.
And there was a great soap opera element to the whole story, too.
Yes. Shadow something?
Like Dark Shadow, sure.
Yeah. No, but I didn't watch that.
Okay.
I never did, but I'm familiar with the character. I thought that Jack Palance would be a far better-looking Dracula than anything I'd ever seen.
And that was your physical model for the look of Dracula.
That was my model.
He did Jekyll and Hyde on television?
Yes, he did. And that came first. And then I even watching Jekyll and Hyde, I said, Jesus, this guy should be Dracula. But, you know, and they gave him a whole makeup job for Jekyll and Hyde, which he played to a T. And it happens to be one of his favorite, if not the favorite film he ever made. After that, he did, not long after, maybe a year later or less, 6 months, he did Dracula. And I didn't think he was as good in Dracula as he was in
Jekyll and
Hyde.
No. And he had such a serpentine-looking face.
Yes, he does. Oh, my God. Yeah, he was a fighter. an ex-fighter.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he has a brother that looks very similar to him.
Let's talk about Blade.
Okay.
Such an interesting character that was a good counterpoint for the series.
And yeah, Bob thought of him. We discussed what he should look like, and a good-looking black guy, young, and wearing, and he would describe how we wanted him to look with a leather jacket and a bandolier around both sides of his chest with little knives in it and one big sword behind him. And then I put boots on him to give him a kind of a rugged, adventurous look. I didn't work all that hard on it. I mean, that was the impression I got as he spoke. And, you know, comic book artists never sit down and with big convention table and discuss how they're going to do this and how they're going to do that. It was always over the phone, very quickly, or in passing each other. They spent a few minutes talking about it, maybe 15 or so, and that would be it. That's all that was required.
And the character is responsible for really Marvel getting into the film business successfully. That really was the film, even before Spider-Man and X-Men, that started the you know,
yes.
Success.
But Marv never made anything out of it, and neither did I.
Yeah, that's pretty lousy. That's pretty lousy.
Yeah, well, I don't know what happened. I think Marvel had a lot to do with it. They wanted the whole damn pie and not share any of it. Stan was Marvel's main editor, but he didn't stay there long.
Right.
Shooter eventually came in, and I knew that day was the worst day of my life. We didn't have a good rapport with each other because I knew what he was up to. He isn't the first one of that type that I'd seen before. And so we never got along, and unfortunately we were scheduled to speak in Connecticut on the radio about comics, and he did the driving. I was the passenger, and there was no one else with us, and he didn't say one word to me on that trip.
Wow.
So I could see, you know, where this was going, and I didn't feel comfortable with it. And eventually, in no time at all, he gave me nothing but trouble. And it was so bad, I had to leave the company. Either that or wind up in the hospital. So I decided, to hell with this. My health is worth more.
Did Tomb of Dracula end first and then you left Marvel, or was it simultaneous?
I think that I just had enough.
Sure.
Before Shooter came on, I believe. And then Shooter came along and he started to write some of the plots. And the whole thing just... I didn't really want to continue with Marvel because it was too long on the one job, and it gets to the point where the writer gets stale and the artist gets stale. They have no further ideas of what to do, and television's the same way. So I wanted to bow out, and then Marv said, well, then he wasn't going to continue to write it either. But we continued to do it anyway. You know, it was mostly just talk.
Were you able then to get to the ending that you guys wanted?
Not really. I can't remember whether he ended it properly or didn't. I just got tired of the damn thing.
Sure.
I don't know if Shooter came aboard before it ended or what, but when he took it over, it got worse.
Sure.
He turned it into a black and white book, too. We didn't get along, so I walked out on a pension plan that I could have had at the time. A lot of good stuff, but I felt that my health was more important.
No, I respect that.
Fortunately for me, I had a place to go, and that was D.C.
Absolutely. And before we get to D.C., one other wonderful project you had at Marvel with Steve Gerber, and that's Howard the Duck.
Yes.
What a funny book. And what was it like doing such an edgy satire at a pretty tame time in the business?
I thought that he was a very unique writer, not typical and by any means, and that he had a lot of talent in him, and he could have written a novel, and he would have done very well. I thought he could have written a screenplay. A wonderful writer and funny as hell. I would really enjoy. See, I never really read these stories, not particularly. But in his case, before I would put a line down, I'd read the books that he had, or the plots that he'd come up with, and I'd laugh my head off. He was a very funny guy.
And what an interesting strip that really showcased your versatility, because...
Yeah.
You had the juxtaposition of all these real people,
yes,
and the very cartoony duck.
Yeah. Well, when I first did it, I thought that Howard looked too much like Donald Duck. Howard never wore pants. He had that little tail in the back, a little feathery tail.
Sure.
He was cute looking, but that's how Donald Duck was presented. And his face was might as well have been Donald, except that Howard wore a hat and smoked a cigar and wore a little jacket. But Disney did get after them. And the Marvel had to change that, so they had me put pants on him, with his little feet sticking out, you know.
Sure.
The duck feet sticking out at the bottom. But the hat was not Donald's hat. It was a regular fedora, beaten up, you know, like someone sat on it for 10 years.
Sure.
And he, what else was it? Just the pants and the hat and the cigar. So that separated him from Donald Duck. But nevertheless, it still looked like Donald Duck. The only other duck that was somewhat different was Daffy Duck. And so how many ways can you draw a duck?
Well, and it's funny because you say he had kind of Donald's body, but I always felt he had Daffy's attitude. And even the expression you gave him kind of had that kind of angry Daffy.
Yeah, he was always angry. You know? he said he was born in a world he didn't ask to be born in. All that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
It opens up with an egg cracking. And then that's how it started. And when we got to do the syndicated strip, that was the very beginning of the syndicated strip, showing the egg and then Donald stepping out, I guess, or peeking out.
and you said that was a back-breaking schedule for you to do both the strip and books.
Yeah, I didn't want to turn it down because it was a syndicate
sure.
thing. Stan promised me the moon and stars if I did it. And none of those things came about because I didn't let go of Marvel's work, which was a good thing. And so I was burning the candles at both ends, and it eventually caught up with me. I just couldn't do it. I'd stay up almost all night.
Wow.
Doing, I think it was Dracula, and then doing Howard the Duck. It got to the point where I just couldn't handle it and lost total interest in doing it. I was so tired, you know, and it
sure.
didn't feel so good. I was really not having the money for myself or my family, but gave it to the doctor.
Wow. Now, some things translate well to film. Unfortunately, Howard the Duck was one that did not.
No.
Did you ever see the film?
Never. No, I never saw it because I heard about that. It would have been better if they had animated him.
Yeah, like Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. That would have been a good thing to do, see?
Sure.
And just Howard. But they went on the wrong path. But, you know, it's all experimentation.
And it's pretty amazing because that was George Lucas.
Yeah.
So
he didn't think ahead. Like, well, look, it's my opinion, and George Lucas had a different opinion. Just didn't work out. Sometimes, you know, you win some and you lose some.
Sure. Well, and it doesn't diminish what you guys did on the book. It was wonderful.
No. Yeah, but the syndicate raised such hell because I dropped it right in the middle. I said, I have had enough. My health is in jeopardy here, and I can't do it. They said, what? You know, because they tied up a lot of advertising in it and money and all that. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't. My health comes ahead of you. And that's how it went.
Did someone replace you then on the strip, or?
I think for a while, yeah, but it just died.
Yeah. No, I remember reading it in the Chicago Tribune as a kid, the strip.
Yeah.
So
if I had only that, it would have been fine, but it wouldn't have really paid the bills. It was a poorly paid thing.
Okay.
So it just didn't work out. Financially, it didn't work out, nor could I actually get it out in time.
Well, after leaving Marvel, you went to DC, and you did great work on Wonder Woman with Roy Thomas, I remember.
Yes.
And of course, Batman as well.
I did Batman, and I did something that Marv had written similar to Dracula.
Oh, Night
Force.
Night Force, oh, yes.
I think it was the first thing I started. Marv went there ahead of me.
Okay, yes.
And then he asked me to come on, and that was my opening to leave Marvel and go to DC.
Was Night Force different enough from Dracula that it was, you know, kind of fresh and...
A little bit.
Okay.
Not all that much, a little bit, though.
Well, sure.
The Night Force character, the main character, was very, very, very much like Dracula. In appearance, he had a cloak and everything.
Sure.
But it was okay. It lasted for a very short time, and it just didn't last at all. It eventually
Well, fans think of Batman and Daredevil as having a lot of similarities, and then someone who's worked on both characters.
Yeah.
Was there a difference to you in terms of approaching the character of Batman?
No, Batman was fully formed, already established. I liked the costuming, and I just slid right in. I had no problem with it. I didn't have to think of anything. Everything was in its place before I took it. And so I just, you know, got into it. It's one of the next jobs they gave me.
Was there ever, and you did so many of the Marvel characters, and also several DC characters, too. Was there ever a specific character at either company that you wanted to draw but never got a chance?
I wish I had done more Westerns. Not characters so much, but Westerns.
Okay.
I did them all the characters, pretty much. But I never got to do much very early, I did Westerns. And then I started to, you know, do other things for different companies. I worked for Quality Comics, too. And that's where Reed Crandall was working. He did Black Hawk.
Yes.
And I had never seen such beautiful pencils in my life. They would be left in the office there in the pencil stage. And I was just drop dead, eyes popping out of my head, looking at these things. And I said, well, I've got a lot to learn, you know.
Wow.
Why can't I get my work to look like this? And so I would study it and try to apply it to my work. I was literally trying to capture his style. I had never met him, but Brandon Eddy, who did the Vigilante? Mort Meskin.
Oh, yes, sure.
I never met him either, but I loved his work. That was at a time when I was trying to break into comics, and I didn't realize what I was getting into and how much I needed to know. So I had a Cook's tour of D.C., and saw some really great stuff. I didn't even know that it was drawn so large, where I would just take out a pad at home, not realizing how it was done, and draw the little panels like they appeared in the comic book.
Wow.
That size. You know?
Right, not realizing that you could draw it of larger scale and they would shrink it down.
Yes, I never did. I never knew how they printed out these books. And actually, I got my job with Stan drawing that way. I did a war story on my own. I lettered it on my own and drew that small size and put the halftones in it, washes, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he hired me based on that.
Wow. Let's talk about, in the 80s, some of your work with Don McGregor. You did Nathaniel Dusk.
Yes, Nathaniel Dusk.
And Detective Zinks as well. He started with Marshall Rogers, but you did one of the Detective Zinks stories,
yes,
too.
Yes, I did. A little period piece. I can't remember the name of it.
No, I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, he did that. I did the penciling, and that's when they started to reproduce my penciling.
Well, because, yeah, that was going to lead me to the other book of McGregor, so that the two of you worked together on, for Vanguard, The Spider.
Yes.
And
that was sponsored by a man that Joel something. I can't remember his last name, but he called me, and he knew Don, and wanted me to do the illustration. Don was doing the writing, and so Don and I have been around quite a bit together. He did the Panther, the Black Panther.
Yes.
And,
did you work with him on the Panther?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
I did. And then I think John Buscema did some work, too. And then we did a horror story for, I think, a Marvel, which was beautifully written. Oh, my. And the first of its kind. And very frightening and very believable. It all takes place in a subway.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I enjoyed that. And Don and I did many things after that. And eventually, we broke up.
Yeah, that's too bad. And it sounds like it happened over this spider story?
It happened over the spider story because it was right after 9/11. And he had something in that story that I didn't approve of. Because it was on the heels of 9/11, it was a similar situation. And I didn't feel that the readership would ever appreciate that kind of thing at that time.
It was a terrorist plot.
Yes, it was, and to blow up the Statue of Liberty. So I didn't want to get into it, and he was furious with me. And so I cooked up a way of trying to... He didn't even want to continue writing it. He was so upset.
Oh, wow.
And then I came up with a plot for it, indicating all the destruction. But it was something that was like a bad dream to the main character, the spider. And something that could have happened, but never does happen.
It happens in his mind rather than actually happening.
Right. And so that way I thought we could get around it and please him at the same time. But he didn't want any of it to be like that. So I think there was a parting of the ways. I still to this day don't feel it. Do not feel that it was a good thing to do. And so we ended it.
Well, now, you've had a couple recent stories. I know you had a story for Dark Horse for their character, The Escapist.
I did one. Yeah, 22 page, something like that.
That's cool. Have you had a chance to read or have you heard about Michael Chabon's book, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay?
Yes, I had a recording of it, of the book read by an actor.
Mm-hmm. Have you had an opportunity to meet Michael Chabon at all?
Yes, once at a convention in San Diego.
Oh, that's great.
I met him there, and then I read Glenn Gould. I met Glenn Gould.
Okay.
Who had written a different kind of a book and one of the bestseller lists. Boy, I tell you, through the conventions and the longevity of being in this business, I've met some very nice people.
Well, they've all been inspired by work like people like yourself.
Yeah, well, see, they're younger.
Sure.
And so they remember my work before they even became professionals, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
The producer of The Last Batman was at the San Diego convention. I met him. He came right over the table.
Is that Michael Uslan?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
The name sounds familiar, but he was a sweet guy. He came over and talked to me for a few minutes. And, you know, to meet a Hollywood bigwig like that, made me feel pretty damn good.
How do you think Hollywood is doing as a film buff yourself and as a comic book expert? How is Hollywood doing in terms of interpreting these characters in the current films?
You mean the comic book characters?
Yeah. How are they doing with them?
Oh, I think they do superb work on Spider-Man and the rest of it, and Batman.
Did you enjoy the new Batman?
I have never seen. I only saw the first one.
Okay. The one from the 80s.
Yeah. And after that, I didn't. I did come to think Hollywood is noted for such fabulous films and taking very popular novels and turning them into films. Why would they go to comic books? You know what I mean? It's like scraping the bottom of the barrel. Why would they do that? Because they had screenwriters and such famous ones.
Oh, sure.
Why would they do such a thing? And I think it's because they thought it was a very saleable thing. And, you know, the studio system is no longer in existence.
That's right.
They got a lot of new guys and all extremely young, they could be my children.
Sure.
At this point. And yet, they're the ones that are controlling Hollywood. The studio system is gone. And most of these films are made by a lot of new companies. It's not MGM or Universal, although they're still in business, or Paramount. New Line came along.
Right.
There's another one out. There's several of them out there that didn't exist at that time. So that's life, you know.
Sure.
The stagecoach had to give way to the automobile. And the Fisher Body people that would turn out these beautiful stagecoaches in its time had to do something else. And when cars became popular, they would have, like the Cadillac would have the Fisher Body, made by the Fisher people.
Yes.
And they used to make stagecoaches. So they had to just plain keep up with the times. And so things have changed, you know. You ask an old guy, how are things today compared to when you was a young man? And he would say, well, they was much better then. You know, when I was a youngster, you can't compare it. And that's the way I feel myself.
But there are, you know, it's interesting. There are artists today who have very contemporary styles, but I think compare favorably with your work as well. And I wonder have you had a chance to talk to a guy like Alex Ross? Because as a painter, he seems to tap into that same realism as yours.
I know. Very realistic. No, yeah. I never met him.
Okay. How about Neil Adams, a guy like
that? Oh,
Neil?
Yeah. I know Neil. And wonderful artwork. Yeah.
Do you guys ever discuss your styles with each other?
No.
Okay.
Styles, but no.
Okay.
No, I don't know. Intimately, I don't know him.
Okay.
But I've met him a few times, and we spoke a few times. He has a company of his own. He does advertising, too.
Yes, Continuity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to do some work for him, but I didn't want to. I just never got together with him.
Well, do you have any new stories coming out? Do you have anything coming up?
No, I actually turned down something from Dark Horse. I can't say it's written in stone, but right at the moment it takes too much out of me to do a story.
I understand.
There are long, long hours at the board now.
Sure.
I'm getting on, and I'm 79 now. And
yes, happy birthday, by the way, last month.
Thank you. But I think it's, I love doing commissions, but I'd like to get out of the doing all these comic things. I'd like to spread out and do something with art. So,
would you like to paint?
Yeah, well, painting with pencil. I've done some things with casein and acrylics that I have in my home. Yeah, I've done some of these things in the past, but I still would like to get away from these comic book characters, which I do not own. You know, these are all syndicated characters, and I would prefer to do something else, and I don't know if the fans would come along with that. What they want are in comic books, and they want these characters, and that's what they're interested in.
Well, you're like a singer performing a song. And, people want, sometimes I think people want to hear, they both want to hear the old favorites, but I think they're also willing to see what's new. And that's what's nice about some of the work you've done for things like Dark Horse that haven't been superhero, and you've been able to kind of,
But it's still, panel-to-panel work.
Sequential art?
Sequential art, right. And it's long, and it's tedious.
Sure.
And sometimes there's six or seven panels on a page. That's a lot of work. And then to make it pay or to even meet the deadlines, you got to do more than a page a day.
Yeah.
I can't really quite make it beyond the page a day.
Wow, that's pretty amazing that you're still able to do a page a day.
Even. Yeah, but I've had enough of it.
I understand.
I have enough, and on top of it, I have glaucoma.
Oh, wow.
And both eyes, and I'm only really working out of one. So, it's amazing I can do what I do.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that people, are able to go to your website at GeneColin.com, and, it's great to see that you are able to still do these great sketches.
I can still. It's amazing how you can make up for a deficiency. You can do things that you never thought you could do. Once I sit down at the board, something takes over, and I can really turn out some fairly decent work.
Well, I can agree with that.
So I kind of like to get into another area of art and see if the fans would be interested in seeing it or buying it. I don't know. I'd like to test the waters there.
Have you displayed any of these new directions on your website?
I have a gallery of my work.
Okay.
But most of it is comics, all comic hero characters. But not much else other than commissions. Now, somebody's commissioned me to do Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
I did one a long time ago with Jack the Ripper waiting in the shadows on a London street, a foggy night, and there's a woman ahead walking towards him, but is not aware of him there.
Sure.
He's in the extreme foreground, and she's way in the background. And then you see the London streets at night, and the wet pavement. I love all that atmosphere stuff. And see, that has nothing to do with comics.
Right. Well, I hope you have the opportunity to show some of these new directions on your website and make the fans aware of it.
Yeah, I think so. That would be a good thing to do. I don't know how interested they would be, because they're all fans of comic books. And that's really what they want, what they're interested in buying. But who knows, if I'll send it out there, maybe it'll fly.
And that's GeneColin.com.
Yeah.
I hope it works out. And,
Thank you very much.
And I appreciate the fact that as an artist, you're still going in different directions and setting new horizons for yourself.
It's very pleasurable to be able, it's a lot of fun to be able to create, go into an area I haven't been in before.
Well, the talent is still there.
Thank you.
And then we wish you luck. And again, I appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you so much.
We've covered a lot of ground, and it's a marvelous career, and it's been my pleasure to reflect with you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Gene Colan from 2005. That doesn't mean that Gene has slowed down in any way. He continues to work and is in the midst of working on a Captain American story for Marvel. Hope to see that when it eventually is finished. And what a wonderful guy. Again, if you have the opportunity to see him at a convention or go to his website, GeneColin.com, and if he still offers to do commissions, take him up on it. Because really, the man is such a master. And I have my own sketch of Blade, one of his original creations, and it adorns my walls proudly. And I'm very happy to have spoken with Gene and hope to do so again in the future. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Sutris. Don't forget, you can normally find Word Balloon all over the internet. We're at iTunes at myspace.com/wordballoon, also comicspace.com/wordballoon. And we've got our Blogger site as well, which is wordballoon.blogspot.com. And our Libsyn site, wordballoon.libsyn.com. Of course, you can find our items at Newsarama, and more new interviews will be coming your way in the days ahead, so be sure to stay tuned for that. And as always, if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.